Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
It is 8 o'clock. It's Thursday evening. This is LA Talk Radio, and you are listening to The Writer's Block. I am your host, Jim Christina, in studio with my lovely and charming co-host, Russ Avison.
You get that lovely in there every
time. I do.
Time.
I try to.
And two weeks in a row.
You are.
You got me 2 weeks in a row. I must be that lovely.
I know, and then we're going to have you 1 week next month, too. If I play my cards right.
You're working me hard.
I am. I have some announcements I have to make, and these are really fun ones. Bobby Jean Bell was not here last week. She was in Albuquerque, New Mexico at the WMA convention. And while she was there, she and her husband, Jim, received the Bill Wiley Award for recognition of their support of Western music and the Western way of life throughout West and their concert series. So congratulations to Bobby Jean Bell. And here, let's give her a little bit of this there. Okay. And tonight their concert series has Adrian Brannon, or Buckaroo Girl. And they are, I believe they still had tickets left, but I don't know now. So we'll be going with that. And I want to also mention the owner of LA Talk Radio, Sam Hassan. And he is such a great guy. And he is, I mean, so opened up his studios for us to come in and play for an hour every week. And he's just really, really, really a good guy. And I'm glad that he has offered this opportunity. And thank you, Sam. In our studio tonight, we have the one, the only, Troy Andrew Smith. He's cowboy, he's a screenwriter, an author,
singer.
A singer, musician, singer. If I left anything out, Troy?
I write a lot of stuff.
Okay. Yeah, a writer.
Yes.
And a writer.
Yeah.
Troy is originally from Nowata, Oklahoma. He has got a degree in what?
Well, actually, I don't have a degree. I'm two classes short from... Oh. Having the degree in film and TV.
That's right, because you went to film school, yeah.
From Montana State University.
Right, and you've been a metal worker, you've been all kinds of stuff.
I've been a lot of different things.
Yeah, well, as have we all, I think. The interesting thing about Troy is his very first book, which is Raidersburg Gold, which, incidentally, I just absolutely loved it. And I believe Russ loved it.
Yes.
Because he likes to name Cletus and... That's right. No, but the story is really, really good. I'm going to let Troy tell you how that book got written.
Well, it was during one of the darker periods of my life, physically
speaking.
Oh,
it won't get any darker than tonight.
it can get a lot darker. No, I had just broken my back, and I was, freshly single, I'll put it that way. And living out in the country, which I usually have been. So anyway, I was going to have back surgery, and they told me I was going to be down on my back or standing up for the next 6 weeks, and couldn't sit or anything or drive or anything else. So I decided that if I was watching TV for 6 weeks, I'd be totally crazy at the end of the time. So I went to Walmart ahead of surgery and got two packs of the big packs of the old Big Pens and a couple of about four, I think, of spiral notebooks. And so I would lay on my back in this brace thing, and I would write upside down while I was laying on the back. And when the pen quit working, I would stick it in one jar, and I'd get a fresh pen out of the other jar. And I would write with it till it quit working, and I'd keep rotating pins. And I figured out it was about, 35 minutes per pin.
That's pretty sad to know that.
Before they quit writing, and And but anyway, that's how I wrote the first draft of Raidersburg Gold, was, you know, laying on my back, which is not the best way to write. I can.
Are there? Do you think there's very many authors that still handwrite their books, their first drafts?
There's fewer all the time. I run across people once in a while that say that they still write everything by hand, but I did it, that first draft of Raidersburg Gold, and then I discovered the computer, and there's no going back, you know, yeah, as far as I'm concerned.
And you know, I found that the older we get, you know, you use your handwriting less and less. So it just, then you go to try to write something, and you can't read what you just wrote. You have to stop and think, oh, wait a minute, how do I do this?
Yeah, it deteriorates quickly.
It really does. You know, it's down to where I can't even hardly sign my name anymore, and I can type it.
Mm-hmm.
But if I try signing it, like at the bank, they look at me, they go, oh, no.
Yeah, that's why most people's signature anymore is just sort of
right. That's
squiggly,
me.
You know.
That's me. Okay, you've got some other stuff out. But before we get into your other stuff, what prompted you to sit down and tell a story? What prompted you to...
No, wait, let's correct it. What prompted you to lie down and
write the story? Well, I mean, tell the story, period. Is it something that had been in your mind for a while? Is it something that you just had an idea and started writing it?
No, what actually happened was I had opened my big mouth too many times and said I was going to write a book one day, but I never had the time. You know, I was just, you know, you're working, you're doing this and that and the other. Now, all of a sudden, I had 6 weeks of time with nothing to do. So I thought, well, I guess I better put my pen where my mouth is and write a book. And somebody somewhere in my past history, some English teacher that had the unfortunate, you know, luck to have me in their classroom, they made the statement that any time in your life, at any given point, you are more of an expert than anybody else on some subject. Like right now, you know, Susie's moving the water bottle, so she would be an expert on moving the water bottle. And so I thought, well, you know, what am I an expert at? And I thought, back pain. And I said, all right, so my hero is, his back hurts. And, you know, so why does his back hurt? Because his horse fell with him. Why did the horse fall? Because somebody shot him, and that's the way it started, and it just kept right on going from there.
How long did it take you to do the first manuscript? I mean, were you done in the 6 weeks that you were on your back?
No, I was only about two-thirds of the way done in the 6 weeks, and then I started in film school, and I started acting on a movie, all kind of by accident, and so it took about another 6 months or so to actually finish it. I was in my second semester of film school at the time that I did finish it, and finished up. I was writing is during finals week, so I was in between tests and at the student union, so I'm in there writing, and I finished up with the last line of the book, and all of a sudden, you know, everybody else is studying for their test, and I jump up and start dancing around in the middle of the...
I'm done.
I finished. I got it. You know.
But that's such a great feeling to finish a book, you know? And it ends the way you want it to end. It's just cool. No better feeling, I don't think.
Why don't you give us a little sketch on what the story is about?
Before you do that, let me give you the numbers. I know there's some people in Oklahoma that are probably listening if they're awake. if you want to call and talk to Troy, the number here is 818-602-4929. That's, again, 818-602-4929. And the Writer's Block is brought to you by Black Dog Publishing in Simi Valley and Out West Marketing, or Out West Boutique and Marketing in Newhall. Okay, you're on, Troy.
All right. Well, Raidersburg Gold is actually a mystery that's set in the Old West in 1874. And Del Williams is a U.S. deputy marshal that's on his way to Raidersburg to investigate a bunch of gold robberies and killings that have taken place there. And he's ambushed en route and winds up underneath his dead horse in a ditch with the partially paralyzed. And that's the premise. And then there's a black frontiersman named Matrimony Fields who is probably the most, most people have said Matrimony's their favorite character in the book.
I like him.
And he comes along and rescues Dell out of the ditch and sort of becomes Dell's eyes, ears, legs around town while he's laid up recuperating from his injuries. And it progresses from there, and we finally find out who the boss and of the gold robbing gang is, and who the sniper is that's been trying to kill Dell all the way through the book. So,
well, it was a good ride, and it doesn't slow. There's no place in this book where you go, oh, I got to get through this dialogue or that. For some action. It's always, it keeps you right.
There's always something going interested. On. Yes. Yeah.
Obviously, yeah. You weren't writing it. Cause,
Well, we'll get to that, too, because the name of the show is The Writer's Block. Yeah.
Actually, it did flow pretty easy, but there's points in every book, I think, that or every screenplay that you write where you just feel like you're just listing off stuff in order to get through it. And then all of a sudden the book kind of takes its own life. And then it's like, you can't write it fast enough to get everything that's going through your head down, you know? So
did you find, because I've only usually come on once a month, but in all the different authors we've talked to, it seems that there's a common thread that sometimes the thoughts or the characters' voices are coming from somewhere else, and it just sort of flows through you. Do you ever find that or feel that way?
I feel that way about every night when I'm dreaming. You know, there's a lot of voices running around in my head, and a lot of them are not too particular about where they're running. But they, it does seem that way because I hear each character differently. You know, it's not like, you know, Del Williams talks the same way Randy Blaine does. He talks the same way as Bug Sweeney. They all have a different voice going in my head. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, they have to, because there's no other way you can write the dialogue for them.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if everybody's that way or not, but I know it's that way for me. It's just, and it's not just the sound of their voice. It's the way they say different words or different phrases and what have you that are unique to them. And like Crazy Tom McCoy was a lot of fun to write his dialogue, you know. So,
well, for a lot of different reasons, which we won't divulge, but yeah, definitely. The other thing I was going to mention is something that came to mind is, and probably about halfway through the book, there's no foul language in the book. And I almost felt I was reading a clean version of Deadwood.
Well, it was written a long time before Deadwood was. That's mm-hmm. that's one thing. It actually was 17 years from the time that I finished writing it to the time that I got it published.
Wow.
And there was a lot of rejections in between there, and I'd finally gotten to the point where I decided I wasn't going to, send it out anymore. I was tired of, some of the letters were really pretty moronic that I got back, from different places. And I just kind of parked it on the shelf, and I went ahead writing other stuff and figured, someday something will take off and then I'll circle back around. And it just happened that I saw an ad looking for historical novels, historical based novels. And the setting and everything, the gold rush and all that stuff, and the book was, historical based. And then mm-hmm. I made up the characters to go with it. And I used a lot of the names of people that actually lived there. And since at that time I was living not far away, and I hunted and I fished up there a lot, and I couldn't drive anywhere to go look at stuff, so I picked a spot that I was very familiar with. Mm-hmm. And that's how come Raidersburg got to be the location.
Yeah, because that is a real town.
Yeah.
Or was. I don't know if it's still is.
It still is. It's listed as a ghost town, but there's probably maybe all totaled around the area a couple hundred people,
really?
On the ranches and stuff.
Is that up by Cascade?
No, it's actually by Townsend or by Canyon Ferry Lake. It's in the Elkhorn Mountains. But it's kind of funny because when you turn off the main highway to go to Radersburg, there's a sign there that put up by, I guess, the highway department or the state. And it tells you how far it is to Radersburg. And then about 20 yards past that is another sign that has a different distance on it. And they're 1 mile different on what they say it is to Radersburg. But my kids and me, we used to laugh at it and said that was the world's shortest mile was between those two signs right there.
Hey, getting back to, you mentioned that it had been 17 years and you had shopped this book around a lot. What are some of the reasons or the rejection letters that you got? What do they give you encouragement? Do they give you advice on what to change, or they just say no thanks?
Well, a lot of them just said no thanks, you know, and you could tell that they'd never opened the package. Mm. You know, they'd never mm-hmm. looked at it. A lot of them, in fact, I got several letters from publishers who said that things like, we really like the book personally, but it's not the kind of book that we normally do. And I always thought, well, if you liked it personally, why wouldn't you figure that other people would like it?
I know. Do you usually publish books that you don't personally like?
Right. Yeah.
Well, yeah, they do.
Yeah. I would guess
so. It's a genre that they publish.
Yeah.
Well, do you think that some of these people are just idiots? I mean, I know in the television business, you know, it's the stupidest thing in the world. Nobody knows what they're doing. And the reasons for either green lighting something or rejecting it are usually political. And I mean, I see some of the stuff that's on television now and I look at it. Well, yeah, money is definitely part of it. But also, I mean, you look at some of the stuff that's on television now and you think, how did this ever get there? And these are hit shows, some of
yeah,
them.
Yeah, like the Real Housewives of...
Well, yeah, reality, of course, the reality show.
Reality
shows.
Isn't. That's what Peter Sirico says. Yeah.
Well, I deal with that all the time because I've got about, I think I counted 34 screenplays that I've written, either spec screenplays of mine or ones I've been hired by other people to write. So, and it baffles me, you know. I work on a lot of them as a wrangler, as a backgrounder, as an actor or whatever. I've done set construction and props and all that kind of stuff on, you know, quite a few different.
Well, hell, you could do your own film. You can do everything.
That's what we're working on. But it ends, you know, I'll be on the set and I'm reading the lines on, you know, this thing, and I'll be going, how did this get the money to, you know, they get the money for this one to get made?
I've been on some with Peter Sirico that I've asked myself the same question.
Yeah, it's amazing. And then, you know, as some of them turn out pretty good, some of them not so well, you know, but that's true, I think, with any, you know.
Right, but you don't think that anybody, well, I would think that it would be very limited to the number of screenplays that are green-lighted, that they go into it with the anticipation that it's going to be bad.
You know, I have actually seen cases, and you don't have to read very far in the books and stuff to find them, but there's a lot of cases where they will take a really bad screenplay, and they admit right off the bat that it's really bad. There's no delusional thing that this is a great screenplay and we're going to, you know. They take a really bad screenplay, and they start trying to fix it up. Now, why they take it, I don't know. It could be, you know, a family matter. It could be, you know, somebody's put some money into it, so they've got some money, so they're going to try to fix it. And they will keep pouring money into this really bad screenplay. They'll get really good actors. They'll get a really good director. They'll get somebody to... You know, and they'll just keep pouring money into it and more money into it, and they go way over budget, and they wind up with a really bad film that started out from this really bad screenplay, and it never changed. Now, they can take a good screenplay and ruin it, you know, if they, you know, if things don't work out right.
Sure.
That happens. But I've never figured out why they start with a bad screenplay and then think they can fix it by putting more money into it.
Or more talent.
Yeah, more talent. I was at a class one night, you know, about comedy, you know, acting and stuff. And the lady that was teaching the class, she said, they always expect the actors to make it funny. She goes, I always just wondered why they didn't write something funny in the first place.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah, I mean, you know, let's be realistic. You know, if it's not funny, it's not funny.
Yeah, but with the canned laugh and all that stuff, you know, they just keep pushing it out there and people keep watching. They keep getting their revenue off the commercials. So it all, you know, life goes on.
It makes you wonder about the common denominator of the viewing audience. I mean, okay, there's a television program called Two Broke Girls.
Yeah. Yes.
I have attempted to watch it twice. I got 5 minutes into it one time before I had to turn it off. I think I got maybe halfway through another episode. And this show, they promoted it. It's supposed to be a big hit. It's in their third season.
It's horrid.
It is. It's awful. And I can't understand it. I did not laugh. I did not find any humor. You know, the actors may be fine. I don't know. But
I've said, you know, a lot of times on the subject of sitcoms that when I was a kid and we watched sitcoms on TV, mm-hmm. everybody in the room would be laughing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can watch a sitcom with a room full of people now, and when it gets over, there might have been somebody went, hmm. You know, and that was the biggest laugh of the whole night, you know, out of
right.
the room full of people. but I don't know how that works, but it's not my, you know, I'm not in charge.
So. There you go. Hey, we're going to take a real quick little break here and give you all a chance to get up and go potty. And we'll be back here in just very shortly. And we are back with Troy Andrew Smith in the studio and Russ Avison and myself. And, of course, I just failed to mention before that Troy's lovely wife, Susie, is sitting here as well. She's waving. And
moving the water bottles.
She's moving water bottles, so she is now an expert. And if you want to call and talk to Troy, the number here is 818-602-4929. And for those of you in Oklahoma, that's 818-602-4929.
Doesn't change.
It's good to keep it simple.
Yeah, okay, right. we're going to move on from Raidersburg Gold now because you have a plethora of other stuff that you have written. You are also a musician, which you gave me a copy of your CD tonight. And I knew that you were a musician. I've just never heard of any of your stuff before, and I will be listening to this on the way home. But, I mean, this is all original stuff.
Yes. It's actually a mixture of poems, mostly cowboy poetry, mm-hmm. and songs that I've written.
And you do the background music as well?
Yeah, well, I do part of it. Actually, one of your guests is on there, John Bergstrom.
Oh.
He plays mandolin and guitar on it. And then Dave Mortigan played guitar and fiddle on it. And I played guitar on it. So we have three guitars, a mandolin and a fiddle.
I'm looking forward.
There's no drums.
I mean, I've seen this CD sitting at every show that we've ever been to together, and I just never grabbed one. Oh, well, you know, it is what it is. Okay, we have got also Murder Maybe, which you sent me a copy, and I have to apologize. I did not get into it other than the opening. But tell us a little bit about Murder Maybe, because it sounds fascinating.
Well, Murder Maybe is set in modern day, one part of the book takes place in Sunland, California, and the other part's taking place simultaneously in Wyoming. So it gives you kind of a peek at both worlds, the way the horse world is around in Southern California here, where most people have to board their horses in you know, some place at a stable. Mm-hmm. And then in Wyoming, where there's big horse ranches where they bring in unbroke horses and have to make them be able to go to work. So it's also a murder mystery. And as you might tell by the title, it's sort of a mystery if there's been a murder actually committed, even though there's two dead bodies. So you have two bodies, but you're not real sure if you have a murder. So it's murder maybe.
Murder maybe, okay.
Well, what was the inspiration for that one? I mean, obviously you have horses and you ride, but where did you come up with this? And especially, how did you come up with an idea of having simultaneous stories going on?
Well, actually, a friend of mine that I work with quite a bit, Kevin McNiven, he has a kind of a unique way of breaking horses out there in Wyoming. And so we wanted to incorporate that into the story. But at the same time, I kind of wanted to show the difference between the way things are in a really urban setting opposed to the way things are out in, for lack of a better word, the real West, you know, outside the city limits kind of thing, where, you know, one place, 2 acres is a ranch, and the other place, 2,000 is considered a small place.
Sure.
You know, so it's sort of trying to give everybody a little bit of a view of something that maybe they don't see from where they live, you know, every day. And then, of course, the murder mystery just comes from my weird imagination. So,
those voices at night.
Yeah. Oh, Susie can tell you about some of the dreams I have. So it's sad to say, you know, but there's some of them are pretty funny. But
you know, I'm not necessarily just in your book, the Radiusburg Gold, but I've noticed that when there's an activity, say someone, I'll use a basic example. Somebody comes out of a saloon and somebody shoots them. And there'll be some activity going around, the bodies on the ground, and the people all run over, and they're talking about what happened. And then the next chapter will start with a seemingly unrelated situation, and then they hear gunshots, they look out the window, and here's that same event that occurred in the previous chapter happening again, but from a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that, at least to me, it's fascinating. I like that little jump back in time a little bit to get the different perspective.
Yeah, because it all depends on where you're standing at the time as to what the experience is, you know. And I don't know. I try to put a lot of stuff into a book because I hate the idea of somebody buying my book and not feeling like they got their money's worth. I want them to have a good trip, you mm-hmm. know, and there's usually, well, there always is. There's some humor in it. There's some places that kind of maybe bring a tear to your eye. There's places that, you know, you'll get your blood charged up and maybe angry at something, or there's action going on that, you know, you want to join in, or, you know. I had one guy tell me that he was actually the guy that I used sort of as my outline for the Dutchman. And I go walking in to a place where he was at, and he yells at me plumb across the room, "I know who the Dutchman was that you put in there, you know." But he gave me a really nice compliment. He said, "When I finished reading that, I wanted to jump in my old truck and run over there to Raidersburg and meet all these people, you know." So.
Well, you told me once that we were at some kind of a writer's thing, and we were talking about authenticity in your writing, and if you can always tell when somebody's doesn't know what they're talking about and when somebody does. And the one that really stuck with me was when they're driving a wagon and mules and they say reins instead of lines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was one that gave it away.
Yeah, you see that a lot. One of the worst ones, and I probably started it, and I apologize for it because I used the term Sugan in one of the books. I think it was Raidersburg. I don't remember now if the first time I used it. And then another writer who's really well known and way bigger writer than I am, it came out with the book about a year later, and he had his protagonist coming in out of the storm, taking a Sugan off and hanging it up and putting it back on to go out in the storm again. And then just a little, you know, a couple of months ago, I found another book that I was reading, and this guy had his character doing the same thing. And I'm putting in there, Sugan's a bedroll. You know, it's made of canvas with a feather tick in it and some wool blankets, mm-hmm. or quilts or whatever they had, and then they rolled their extra clothes up in it, so like a suitcase, and then they either had a pack horse to carry it or they put it in the wagon of Brandon. Right. It was way too big to
put on.
There was no sleeves in it to put on, you know, or anything. So that kind of stuff kind of, for me, kind of, takes away from the story,
right?
Because, in fact, I can. There is a book that's made into a movie that did really well, and more power to them. But I hated the book because every time I got to getting into the story, there would be one of these kind of things that would happen that, you know, just doesn't happen that way, you know. And it would just scream fake, you know, mm-hmm. to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to mention the name because I don't want to upset people that liked it. And I don't care if they liked it or not. For me, I just didn't like it because there was just too much stuff that the author didn't know what he was talking about. And he really didn't put much effort into finding out. That was the part that bothered me, because a lot of the stuff he could have found out by picking up an Outdoor Life magazine or, you know, a Western Horseman.
Western Horseman, yeah. You get a lot of good
information. Well, you know, that's really a good point. And since both of you write in the same time period,
mm-hmm.
Do you find that you have to do a lot of research before or during the writing of the book?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It depends on what I'm writing about.
Yeah. And it depends, you know, that like with Raidersburg, I'd probably been doing 10 years of research because I'd been over there hunting and fishing mm-hmm. all the time, you know, and roping and working cattle and what have you. So, you know, all of that's research to a writer, you know. And one thing I will warn people, because, you know, I have a face, I guess, that people think I need to know what their business was, because they'll run up and tell me, you know, these most, you know, personal, intimate kind of things, you know. I had a guy at a bar one time up in Montana, and he was a nice kid. And there was a song starting to play that I wanted to go dance to. And out of the crowd, this guy, I didn't even know him, he just steps in front of me and he goes, "That was me and my fiance's song. And she was killed in the car wreck." And he starts. And I'm like, "Hold that thought right there. I'll be right back.
Yeah. Let me grab a pen." You can't make this stuff up.
Oh, my gosh.
So anything that somebody tells me, I got to warn them that it could wind up in a book someday.
Well, absolutely. You know? Absolutely. I mean, you know, I'm sure that you're the same way. If I'm going out of something I'm comfortable with, like mm-hmm. currently I'm on the return about cowboys going to Louisiana and having to deal with a swamp. And this, you know, a swamp is no place for cowboys.
Right.
But the Cajun language is so hard to write.
Mm-hmm.
because it's got so much French mixed with Cajun, mixed with, what's the other one, Creole and English, and it's just, they talk and nobody knows what they're saying.
Right.
And yeah. to write that down as dialogue is really hard, I have to tell you.
Yeah, I had in Cannon House, I have one of my characters is in New Orleans, and I ran into that same thing. But I was also a fan of Justin Wilson's, who was the cook in Cajun.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd watched every show of his, so I kind of had an ear for the sound of it,
but
you know.
The old Cajun is so much different yeah. than what they speak now.
Yeah, and it's funny, but... they make interesting characters.
They really do. They really, really do. And these guys are going to be fascinating. So I just say that because...
I don't want to go backwards just because we mentioned Deadwood just for a minute. And listen, if there's foul language, I don't care one way or the other. It doesn't offend me, but it's a pleasure to read a book that doesn't have it. But as far as authenticity, was that kind of language that you heard in Deadwood, was that really going on at that time? Because we've discussed that before.
And you know, I still think that the I don't think it was that bad. I think it was because it was mostly a man's world.
Yeah, I was going to say I think they were pretty accurate, and I worked on the show for all three seasons, so I was, it was a great job. I really enjoyed working there, and working on it. The cast and crew were great, and it was a lot of fun, but. I think the only thing that they might have erred as far as the language went is I don't believe that they talked that way in front of the women that much.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the West, even a whore was a really kind of a treasured item because there wasn't very many women, you know, in the Black Hills at that time. And so I think there was a little more consideration for the opposite sex.
Yeah, they were held up more way. On a pedestal.
Yeah, even if they were one of the girls on the line, because a lot of the line girls became rich wives of, you know, copper barons and
mm-hmm.
gold miners and like that, because there just wasn't a lot of women out in the West at mm-hmm. that time.
How much money was a lot of money then? I remember that your main character talked about having $20 in his pocket, and that was at the time. He said, at that time, I felt rich.
Yeah.
But what was considered a lot of money?
Equivalent of $500 now.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, at least, you know, because, you know, you could get, even when I was a kid, and I'm not going to tell you how long ago that was, but, you know, I used to could take 50 cents and go down to Mabel's Cafe down in anybody in Nowata that's listening knows where that was. And for 50 cents, I could get a hamburger, a bottle of soda pop, and you guys call it soda out here. We always call it pop. So,
right.
You know, you get a pop, a hamburger, and then I had my choice. I could either get a piece of coconut cream pie or I could get French fries.
And this is all for 50 cents.
And actually, I'd have a nickel left over. So I could save the nickels.
So 45 cents.
Yeah.
So I could save the nickels back. And then about once every week or so, I could have the French fries
and the
pie.
Well, that was back in the days where movies were nickel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of stuff was a quarter when I was a kid.
Yeah.
You know, that seemed to be the price. So if you go back another 100 years in front of that, you know, a nickel was quite a bit of money.
Mm-hmm.
You could get, you know, for a couple of pennies, you could get something. But at the same time, if you were in a gold rush town, then the prices would be exorbitant.
Oh, right. Sure.
You know.
Because they could get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but I always like when the guys walk in, like into the bar and says, give me a bottle and a glass. And they set it down. He just throws some coins in there. They have a little pouch, just toss it under. Nobody ever, at least in the movies, nobody ever counted. They just like, okay, whatever, and they just took it.
Yeah, that's because that slows the movie up.
Right. You know, a really good example of that, though, the cost and the prices back then, there's a Jamie Stewart movie called The Far Country.
Yeah.
and it's about the gold miners in Alaska, mm-hmm. or Yukon, I guess.
Yukon, yeah.
And they go, and they and as they're sitting in this bar, the prices are going up on the food.
Yeah, that was very true, because, and if you ever see the pictures of what those miners had to go through to get into the Yukon.
Oh, yes.
That is, it's unbelievable that people would torture themselves that bad just to take the chance on getting rich.
Yeah, they used to have to go up Dead Horse Pass.
Dead Horse Pass?
They called it Dead Horse Pass because most horses died on the way up.
Yeah.
Wow.
Very few horses were taken over it because of the steepness and the altitude and everything. But do you remember, it was like 2,500 pounds of provisions that each person had to have with them, or the Canadian Mounties would not let them into the Yukon.
Wouldn't let you into the Yukon.
2,500 pounds.
Yeah, 2,500 pounds of provisions.
And how
per,
many
per person?
How many pack animals would it take to carry 2,500
pounds?
They
didn't have pack animals.
So they
had to carry it up by hand, and each
or pull it on a sled.
Have to make several trips, you know, up and down this incredibly steep pass.
That's insane.
That's
it is insane.
That was my point. I mean, if you see the pictures of it, you'll realize how insane it actually was. And then they had
where we got helicopters from, right?
Pretty much.
And then they had to have somebody at the top of the pass that would guard their stuff while they went down to get another load. So they had to work in teams, you know, to get in there, or else somebody would just come along, pick their stuff up, and then sell it back to them. You know, well, this is
hey, we're going to take another real quick break here, and then we'll give you a chance to go potty and do what you got to do. And we're back, and if you're just now joining us, why did you wait so long? We have Troy Andrew Smith with us tonight in the studio, and he's actually quite fascinating. And he's a good writer.
Surprised you, huh?
No, he did not surprise me. After having, you know, been acquainted with Troy for a number of years now, no, nothing he does surprises me.
Where'd you guys first meet?
At Out West.
Yep, I think so.
A writer's thing. It was the Friday before the first time I went out for the Cowboy Festival.
Yeah.
So that was 2010.
Well, you know, it's funny that you asked that, you know, about what did you think it'd be, you know, whatever you said there, boring or whatever. But one of the biggest insults that has, I hate to use the word insult, but for lack of a better word, that's what I can come up with. But people come up to me all the time, and they've done this for years, and it's not just with writing or anything, but they'll come up to you and they'll go, "Boy, I read that book you got there of Raidersburg Golden. I didn't know you could write like that." You know,
like what?
And it's like what? Do I look stupid? Or, well, never mind. Don't answer that question.
Don't answer that. Looks are deceiving. You know?
But they do that. You know, I didn't know you could rope like that. I didn't know you could bulldog like that. I didn't know I didn't know you could act like that. And it's like,
you should look at him and go, "I didn't know you could ask such stupid questions like that."
Here's your sign.
Yeah. that's kind of become my pet peeve insult, you know, and I know they mean it as a compliment,
right,
and you know, so I don't really get mad at him or anything, but I always just wonder, well, what did you think I could do?
Yeah. Oh man, Jimmy, I didn't know you could talk on the radio.
I didn't either. I just showed up one day and they let me in the door, and God bless them.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, yes. It really truly is. I come in here every week is a lot of fun anyway.
Mm-hmm.
We get to talk to some of the best people.
Yeah. So how many books have you written total now?
Five books that have been published, and the last three I've self-published just on the on Kindle and electronically like that, because actually the last two I self-published, and then the one before that and the ones before that I've put on the electronic, you know, because it got a little discouraging when, you know, you publish a book and it goes out there and you never see a check off of it. And when I did it on the electronic, I get a paycheck pretty quick. They're not very big, and there's not near enough of them yet. But
they keep coming, a little bit.
Keep coming in every little bit, and it's a lot nicer to get a little check than no check.
Right. So. Well, it also has got to be good for, you know, just your self-confidence. That, you know, there are some people out there that like this thing. And you know, you might have a book that maybe you could sell, I don't know, 10,000 copies, let's say. But a big publisher, you know, if they can't sell 500,000 copies, they're not interested in talking to
you. That's very true. And the other thing, too, and I just read this lately, they said if you're into self-publishing, that it's like growing a garden, except it takes about 5 years before your book really starts getting the interest that you are hoping for. It takes that long through all the media, the social media, and word of mouth and everything before it starts building up.
Yeah. That's when you have to get into the shameless self-promotion.
Yeah. Yes.
Like Long Ride to Morning.
Oh, which was a good idea, by the way. When you know, I've got your book here, Troy. Yeah. And when Jimmy gave me to read it, he had his little bookmark in here, which was for his book.
Mm-hmm.
So, which I've read both, and I really didn't need your, you know, if this costs you a nickel, you can have that back.
No, those didn't even cost a nickel.
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to ask you the question: writer's block. Have you ever had it?
No,
never.
No. The reason is, and I think this is another piece of advice that was given to me somewhere along the line. I would like to give credit to whoever said it, but I don't remember who that was. But they said if you get into a bind where you don't know what to do, you know, you're having writer's block, your character said introduce another character.
Wow, that's interesting.
And I've found that to work really well, and
that's why you had 212 characters.
Yeah, you can see how often I had to add another character, you know. But
well, you know Margaret Brownlee.
Yes,
her thing was is that she goes back and she changes the story.
Well, I just hate to change what I've already written. You know, it's kind of a lazy characteristic of mine. But
although, I guess you could kill one off, too.
Yeah, you can kill one.
Oh, I do that all the time. People get so mad at me.
Yeah. And you know, the thing of it is, though, is anytime you introduce a new character, even if it's a small, very small part, it adds another dimension into that scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I mostly write, and this is not consistent because sometimes I've known what the end of a story was before I ever started on the front, you know. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I've just had an idea, like with Raidersburg, I just, you know, I knew what back pain was, so I started from there. So there's a lot of different ways I come up with the story. But the, I had a point here. But This is one of those writer's block moments. Yeah, this is another reason why I write instead of talk, you know, because if I have it down on paper, I remember where I was going.
There you go. Well, look, we are running out of time. Why don't you give us the information, your contact information, if you would, your email address and website, and if you have one.
Well, the website is being redone right now, but when it gets back up and running, it's just Troy Andrew Smith at TroyAndrewSmith.com.
Okay.
Yeah. And then my email address is TroyAndrewSmith@gmail.com. Right. So I keep it pretty simple. And
Facebook?
Facebook, I'm same story, Troy Andrew Smith. So, you know, I'd like to. The reason for that is there's another writer whose name is Troy Smith, who also writes Westerns.
Oh. And yes, he's going to be on next year, actually.
He's on the East Coast. We laugh a
Troy
lot about
Dean,
confusing people, you know, as to whether it's him or me that, you know, they're people are talking about.
Does he sell more books than you?
Oh, yeah. He's been at it a lot longer than I have.
So good. Maybe they'll make people make a mistake and they'll buy your book thinking it's his, you know? It all works.
I had somebody the other day bragging on one of my books and I'd never heard of it before. You know?
Yeah, that's when you say thank you and move on quickly.
Right.
Well, we appreciate you coming in with us tonight, Troy. And of course, Susie, thanks for bringing him. It's always a pleasure seeing you guys.
And next time, Susie, don't hog the conversation.
Yeah, next time we're giving you the mic. Next year, January, first show in January, you might be interested in this, is Craig Johnson, who is the creator of Longmire.
Yeah.
So he's going to be joining us from New Mexico, I believe, on telephone. And that's going to be, really looking forward to that. Next week, as we have Thanksgiving, we're going to be doing an encore presentation from October 15th with Claire Fullerton, who was a great guest to have in here. She was a lot of fun. And then that's, of course, Thanksgiving. And then our Christmas show is December 17th. So we're going to have a good time. We have a good time. So thanks again, Troy, for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Russ, always a pleasure having you in here with me, my friend.
It is, isn't it?
It is. We just love it so much. And I think with 1, 2, 3, we've killed another Thursday. We're out of here.